Lecture 3, The Doctrine of Reincarnation.
In our last lecture, we talked about the classical Indian quest for knowledge. In this lecture, I want to put one more crucial piece in place in our understanding of the Indian religious background in the time of the Buddha, so that we can begin in the next lecture to study the life of the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching themselves. This one final remaining crucial piece has to do with the Indian view of the afterlife and the doctrine of reincarnation. If we look back into the early Vedic literature that we talked about last time, the tradition particularly of the early Vedic hymns, we find that the view of the afterlife was really quite similar to the view that's found in some of the European traditions that are really familiar to us. It's a familiar view, and one probably that belonged in some way to all of the people who called themselves Arya and who migrated across Europe and down into India. This view is that people who live a virtuous life, live a good life in this world, play by the rules, and perhaps express themselves in some sort of heroic way or achieve some sort of particular eminence, go to live in the land of the ancestors when they die. This belief persists in some aspects of Hinduism today, because Hinduism is a complex tradition that really involves many layers. When families make their pilgrimage to the sacred city of Benares on the river Ganges in North India, they make offerings to feed the ancestors and to ensure their prosperity in the afterlife. This ancient ritual goes back into the early traditions of the Vedas, and it's related, of course, to this view that the ancestors have moved into another realm and they need to be fed in order to ensure their prosperity. Now, sometime during the first half of the first millennium, before the Common Era, this ancient view began to be replaced by another one we call the doctrine of reincarnation. By the time of the classical Upanishads, Indian sages, the sages of the Upanishads, took the position that human beings didn't live just one life, but cycled around again and again, life after life. If you want to draw this for yourselves by making gestures in the air, you would simply draw circles. They cycled around life after life, death after death, in a process of death and rebirth. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there was a sage named Yajnavalkya, one of the great heroes of the Upanishads. We don't talk about him very much because his name is so hard to pronounce, but he was one of the really remarkable figures in that Upanishadic literature. He compared the succession of human lives to the movement of a caterpillar from one blade of grass to another. It's a very nice metaphor, actually, to express this movement of the soul from one life to another. He said, it's like this. As a caterpillar, when it comes to the tip of a blade of grass, reaches out to a new foothold and draws itself onto itself, so the self, after it has knocked down this body and rendered it unconscious, reaches out to a new foothold and draws itself onto it. Nice image. A caterpillar crawling from one blade of grass to another. Later in the same text, it talks more about the mechanism of the doctrine of reincarnation. It says that when human beings are cremated, the smoke from the cremation pyre rises up into the sky, and there the soul can move in three different directions: on, out of this world into the realm of Brahman, back into this world as a human being, or into one of the lower realms of rebirth, as into the body of a worm, an insect, or a snake, one of those things that crawls along the ground. In fact, I won't bore you with this, but there are some quite nice descriptions in some of this literature about what it's like to be reborn as a worm in a dung heap. They say that if this is your this is the fate that is reserved for you, that the dung heap will begin to smell extremely attractive as you're making your way through the intermediate state of the afterlife. Now, This doctrine, this idea of reincarnation, is known in English as by a number of different words. Reincarnation is simply one of them. We also speak in English of transmigration, to transmigrate, to move across into some other world, or we speak of rebirth. In Sanskrit, in the language of ancient India, this phenomenon is called by another word, samsara. The word samsara means simply to wander from one life to the next. And it already begins to suggest to you what the emotional valence is that's associated with this idea in classical India. Here we're not talking so much about a direct straight line where you're marching through one life after another in order to achieve a particular goal, but actually an experience of wandering as you're tossed around from one life to the next, not knowing fully how it is you got where you are or where it is you're really going to end up. Now, this doctrine of reincarnation affected Indian religious thought in two important ways that I think are really important for us to think about together in order to understand the emotional drive that motivates Indian religion. Because we, I suspect, coming from a Western religious environment or a Western cultural environment, are likely to think of reincarnation in a certain way, perhaps as a possibility that would allow us to come back into this world and experience again something that we really missed in this life, something positive, something really to be sought. It tended not to work out that way in India for two rather important reasons that separate the Indian view of reincarnation from any view that you're likely to have encountered in contemporary American religious life. In the earliest texts, this doctrine is depicted as being a rare and secret teaching. So at first, it was not something that was accepted by everybody. But very quickly, by the time of the Buddha, it became what I think we have to understand is the fundamental assumption of Indian religious life. As it's not a doctrine that you can take or leave. It's not a doctrine that you can pick or choose. It's simply the starting point for Indian religious reflection. This is very difficult for new students of Indian religion fully to grasp, and I must say that I, even myself, have trouble grasping the full significance sometimes in my own conversations with Buddhists. I think everyone, when they go to India for the first time and have studied a little bit of Indian religion, try to find some moment when they can sit down with an Indian religious teacher and say, well, Swamiji, or oh great guru, I've heard a little bit about this doctrine of reincarnation. There's nobody listening. We can close all the windows and we won't record anything that we're actually talking about here. Tell me, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that when you die, you're reborn in another body, and that this life that you have now is the result of infinite numbers of lives that have extended on into the infinite past? And I found when I first asked this question, I was as naive as anybody else when I went into India and began to try to unlock some the meaning of some of these things for myself. When I first asked this question, the particular monk I was speaking to looked at me as if I had just stepped out of a spaceship. He said, you mean you would question that? You mean that's something that you would doubt? It's so obvious, in a way, as the starting point for Indian religious thought, of course, Buddhist thought beyond India as well, that it's almost inconceivable that one could question it. It's really where Indian religious life begins. So as we try to think and feel our own way into this remarkable and complex tradition, we have to begin to think of reincarnation as really the starting point for Indian religious thought. Now, there's a second feature of this doctrine, too, that's important for us to come to some understanding of. In the West, we sometimes think that reincarnation is an opportunity to have something that we may have missed this time around. For a long time, I used to think of myself as a frustrated baseball player, as a shortstop in the making who really didn't have the physical skills or the body to go out and be a great success on the baseball field, and instead I had to settle for second best and become somebody who made his way by crawling from the tip of one grass blade to the next in the stacks of Widener Library at Harvard. And I thought maybe if I came back in another life that I could be that great baseball player that I wanted to be in this life. It strikes us that way. Why not? If we're reborn in another life, wouldn't we try to manipulate our lives in this world so that we could come back in a form that would be more attractive or more pleasurable to us? In India, for reasons that are important to think about, the doctrine of reincarnation didn't work out that way. It came not to be viewed as being an opportunity, but to be viewed instead as a burden. And part of the reason for this is that Indian civilization, in the centuries that began to lead up to the life of the Buddha, came to view reincarnation not as a single life or as two or three lifetimes strung together, but on a time scale that involved millions and millions of lifetimes. So that whatever those challenges were that you wanted to meet in some new life, that you wanted to come back in order to confront, perhaps to overcome, began to seem very small in the large scale of personal and cosmic history that you were involved in. One of the best ways to get a sense of the emotional impact of this idea is to consider one of my favorite stories. It comes out of a body of Hindu texts where stories are elaborated about things like the doctrine of reincarnation. It's a story about the god Indra and a Brahmin boy. The story starts like this. Indra has just won a great victory. He's actually slain a demon that held the waters of creation in its belly, and he has released the waters of creation over the world and begun to bring the whole process of set the whole process of creation in motion. And in order to celebrate this, he decides to build a palace, like William Randolph Hearst at San Simeon. He gets the divine architect Vishwakarman to design for him the most perfect throne room and guest houses and kitchens and palatial dining rooms and all of that sort of thing. And he builds and builds and builds so that Vishwakarman, the divine architect, eventually simply becomes tired of all of this. So he goes to the god Brahma and asks him for help just to cool down some of the enthusiasm that's driving Indra on this massive building project. Brahma manifests himself as a Brahmin boy, as a child, and he goes like Nachiketas to visit Indra in his palace, and Indra is required by the custom of that culture to provide lavish entertainment and a beautiful welcome for the child. So he brings out food, music, and entertainment, and all of that sort of stuff, presents it to the child, and the boy begins to weep. Looks down at the floor, and he breaks out into tears. Indra is stunned by this, so he looks at the boy, and he asks, "What's wrong?" And the boy points to a line of ants running across the floor, and he says, "Indra, each one of those ants was an Indra just like you in a previous life. And not just one time, but millions and millions and millions of times. And that will happen to you. You too someday will fall down from your position as the king of the gods, and you'll be an ant crawling across the floor of someone else's throne room." And Indra, of course, is stunned by this new vision of himself in this vast scale of time in which even the most extraordinary achievements eventually decay and slip away. So there's a lot, obviously, about this doctrine that's important for us to consider intellectually, but I think it's important at the very beginning to understand it emotionally. and understand the emotional impact of reincarnation when it's visualized on this massive time scale. It becomes a burden to be born, a problem to be solved, rather than an opportunity to be exploited by looking forward into a future life. So we begin our study of Indian religion in part with this fundamental problem, the problem of reincarnation. It's fundamental, it's burdensome. What can we do about it? What do we do to lift this burden? The answer to that question in India comes from considering something that we call the law of karma. It's really the law of retribution that governs and drives the cycle of transmigration. The word karma is a word that's pretty common in our world. I haven't looked it up in the dictionary recently to see whether it's made its way into the discourse of the dictionary, but it certainly is in the discourse of our culture. You know what it means to say that somebody has bad karma. It means something like bad luck that probably springs from something that they've done in the past, either in this life or in some previous life. In India, the word karma simply means action. So bad karma is a bad action, good karma, a good action, that then bears its result. It sticks with you, and it bears its result in this life or the next. So the cycle of death and rebirth, the cycle of samsara, is driven by an inexorable law. What you do now will bear some result in some future life. You have to find some way to work with this law in order to permit some positive solution to the problem of samsara. Now, you might ask, as we talk about the law of karma, where karma can lead you? That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask about India. What are the possible realms of rebirth? There are somewhat different pictures of this in different aspects of the Indian tradition, but generally it's possible to think of six realms into which you can be born. You can be born as a god, as a demigod, a lesser category of god, sometimes referred to as a demon, but it actually is just one more category of divine figure. As a human being, as a ghost, as an animal, or as a spirit in hell. Sometimes people are surprised when they hear that that hell is an important concept in Buddhism or in Indian religion more generally, but it is. It's very traditional. It's very important in the overall structure of Indian religious life to realize that there are places where you can go, and they're quite elaborately described in some literature, where you can really be punished. So if you perform bad actions in this life, there really are some important ways in which you will suffer for it in some future life. Now, the law of karma allows two strategies, two possible ways to deal with the problem of samsara. You might almost be able to think of them yourselves if you begin to work theoretically with the law of retribution that I've just laid out for us. One of these I call the ordinary norm, just the ordinary way of doing things. It's followed by most Indian people, and it's the most obvious way of responding to the challenge that we've been talking about. If you're an ordinary Indian person, what you try to do is perform good actions to get a good rebirth. What could be more simple than that? Do your duty. Do the things that are specified for you as a member of Indian society, as a member of the Brahmin caste or the princely caste, as a father or a mother, as a son or a daughter, a student, a teacher, whatever that is. There are special duties that accrue to you in that part of the world. You should make sure you do them right. And if you do, then good things will happen to you in some kind of a future life. The best thing that you can get in a future life would be rebirth in heaven. That's as high as you can go. You can be up there with Indra as one of the gods in heaven. But as in the story of Indra and the Brahmin boy, the problem with this approach to the law of karma is that it's impermanent. It slips away. If you go and live with the gods in heaven, you, like all the other gods, eventually begin to lose your luster. The impact of your karma begins to wither and fade, and you begin to fall down into the cycle of transmigration all over again. So it's possible to be reborn at a high level and to live a pleasurable life as the result of your past karma, but it's impermanent and it slips away. It's not something that you can hold on to forever. It's possible, in rare instances, to follow another norm, to approach the law of karma in a very different way that challenges a lot of our presuppositions about the way religious life works. I call this the extraordinary norm. This is open only to a few people, or shall we say chosen only by a few people. It may very well be open to everybody, but only a few people choose it. According to this norm, someone would attempt to perform no action. Not good action, not bad action, but no action at all. Either good or bad. And the goal of this mode of action, this extraordinary norm, is not to get a better rebirth, not to kind of win on the scale of transmigration or reincarnation, but to get no rebirth at all and bring the cycle of transmigration completely to an end. It's a very distinctive idea, as you can see, just to bring the cycle of transmigration to an end. This state of no rebirth, the end of the cycle of samsara, is called commonly in Hindu literature moksha. That means liberation, so you'll hear it referred to that way often in the religious literature of India. Buddhists refer to it as nirvana. So this, of course, is the great goal that the Buddha was seeking in his meditative and contemplative life, to seek nirvana, the end of the cycle of transmigration. Once a person has achieved this state, once you get there, there is no return in the cycle of death and rebirth. That means it's permanent. It doesn't slip away from you. So if you want a solution to the problem of samsara, this is what you got to do. You got to find some way to bring this cycle completely to an end. Now, if you think about this, with these two norms, then, come two very distinctive styles of life in Indian society. Two very different ways you can live as a religious person in Indian civilization. People who follow the ordinary norm situate themselves in a network of duties and responsibilities. They live the life of ordinary people. They're mothers, fathers, teachers, students, priests, kings, and they're bound by all the rules that govern these social roles. People who follow the extraordinary norm renounce all of this. And I use the word renounce here in really a technical sense. They give it all up. They engage in an act of renunciation so that these duties no longer apply to them and they no longer occupy any distinctive place in the established structure of Hindu society. In other words, they really turn their back on all the social duties that would normally accrue to someone in that world. These renunciants, they're called by various names. Sannyasi is one. It's commonly used in the Hindu tradition, although it could be used for Buddhists as well. Buddhists refer to bhikshus, the word we translate as monk. It originally meant simply to beg. Or bhikshuni, a nun, a woman who has engaged in the same act of renunciation. They have very few possessions. They beg for their food, and they live lives that are deliberately simple in order to escape the network of karma that ties them in the cycle of samsara. Now, you might find it interesting to attempt to visualize for yourself what somebody like this would look like. I've given an abstract description to you of the possibility of sannyasa, What does it look like to meet a sannyasi on the street? And what would it be like to try to become a sannyasi for yourself? The story that I often use to introduce students to this ideal in Indian life is one that I think is in some ways a little bit odd, but is rather distinctive and amusing. There was a man once, let's start out with once upon a time, there was a man named Leopold Fischer, who was born and grew up in Vienna in Austria before the Second World War, and he showed an unusual aptitude for Indian languages. I'm sure he must have imagined, or others might have imagined for him, that this was the result of some previous connection with that great civilization. Anyway, he came of age during the Second World War and joined the Nazi army, the Army of the Third Reich, and was assigned to the Indian Legion to defend the Normandy beachhead against the invasion by the Allied forces. He was captured with his Indian troops and was repatriated. I put this word in quotation marks. He was sent with his troops back to India, even though he had never actually lived there himself. And when he got to India, he tried to imagine what to do. Now he was there, and he could speak the languages and was at home with his Indian troops. He went up to Benares on the Ganges and tried to find a teacher who would initiate him as a sannyasi. Initially, his attempts to do this were not terribly successful because people were reluctant to initiate foreigners into this institution, into this style of life. But he found, finally, someone who would do this for him. So the guru, the teacher, took him down to the Ganges, to the bank of the Ganges, to the cremation ground where the bodies are burned along the shore of the river during the dark of the moon. And he asked him to go through a very simple ritual that involved, in effect, a ritual death. There was a cremation pyre that had been set up for him. He stripped off all of his clothes, took off all the marks of his previous identity, and laid down on the pyre and was symbolically cremated to indicate, in effect, that he no longer was the person that he was. He rose up from the pyre, went and took a bath in Mother Ganga in the Ganges, came out of the river and was wrapped in the robe of a sannyasi and given a begging bowl and a new name and sent off to walk the roads of India as a renunciant and an ascetic. His new name was Agehananda Bharati, homeless. Agehananda means homeless bliss. He went on then to have a very distinguished and interesting academic career in India and ended up as a professor of anthropology at Syracuse University. So it doesn't always work out quite the way you would expect. But the story itself is extraordinarily vivid, and it shows you something important, I think, about the idea of sannyasa in India, that it involves ceasing completely to be the person you were, to stop the cycle of transmigration. So you could imagine, I suppose, if you wanted to speak about this intellectually, that the goal of this form of religious action in India is to negate karma, simply to stop it. And you could, you'll have to do this with your mind's eye, not with anything that I can present to you here, either verbally or on the screen, that I've written on the blackboard. Imagine that I've written on the blackboard the phrase, I act. That is, I produce karma. That's what you want to stop if you want to escape the cycle of transmigration. And you can, of course, cross out the word act if you want. You can really diminish the number of things that you're responsible for in this world and the number of things you do. That, of course, is something that Buddhist monks do. They have few possessions. Why? There's less that they have to protect, less that they have to worry about and be responsible for. They beg food every day. Why? Because they don't want to have to cook, want to have to be responsible for that kind of sustenance in their life. So you try, in quite a serious way, to diminish the number of things that you do and that you must do in this world. But a more fundamental way to erase that phrase, to negate the concept that I am performing an action, is to negate the I. To take the word I off the blackboard, so that it no longer is you who performs the action. There no longer is a you there who is connected in some responsible way to the actions of this world. That's what Agyehananda Bharati did, of course, in that symbolic action by the Ganges when he laid down on the cremation pyre and was symbolically burned. But that, too, is a crucial aspect of the Buddhist tradition as well. Buddhists also are trying to find a way to negate the sense of self that drives the cycle of death and rebirth. And all of that we'll have a chance to talk about in more depth when we talk in the next lecture about the life of the Buddha, and then move on to the Buddha's teaching.